Good day, and welcome to the Trust for America's Health Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, SSM.media call. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Jeff Levy. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Anna. Good morning. My name is Jeff Levy, and I'm Executive Director of Trust for America's Health. Thank you for joining us today for the release of our annual report, Evidence and Fat, How Obesity Threatens America's Future. The report is being released by Trust for America's Health and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. A copy of the full report, including state-specific information, is on our website at www.healthyamericans.org. I'm honored to be joined today by Dr. Jim Marks, who is Senior Vice President and Director of the Health Group at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. I'll start off the call with the key findings from the report, and then Jim will talk about the big picture of the obesity epidemic in the United States and policies and recommendations that can make a difference. Obesity is one of the most challenging health crises the country has ever faced. Two-thirds of adults and nearly one-third of children and teens are currently obese or overweight, putting them at increased risk for more than 20 major diseases, including type 2 diabetes and heart disease. It's not just our health that is suffering. Obesity-related medical costs and a less productive workforce are hampering America's ability to compete in the global economy. In the past year, we found that obesity rates have increased in 16 states and did not decrease in a single state. 12 states now have obesity rates above 30%. 4 years ago, only one state was above 30%. Mississippi has the highest rate of obesity for the seventh year in a row. Colorado has the lowest rate and is the only state with an obesity rate below 20%. Obesity rates remain the highest in the South and are lowest in the northeastern and western states. Racial and ethnic minority adults and those with less education or who make less money continue to have the highest overall obesity rates. For instance, nearly 33% of adults who did not graduate from high school are obese, compared with only 21.5% of those who graduated from college or technical college. For the first time, this year's report examined how the obesity epidemic has grown state by state over the past 20 years. What we found is there was a clear tipping point in our national weight gain over the last 20 years, and it had serious ramifications for our health and healthcare spending. 20 years ago, no state had an obesity rate above 15%. Today, 38 states have rates above 25%, and only Colorado is below 20%. Since 1995, obesity rates have doubled in seven states and increased by at least 90% in 10 additional states. In the past 15 years, obesity rates have grown the fastest in Oklahoma, Alabama, and Tennessee, while the growth has been slowest in Washington, D.C., Colorado, and Connecticut. We also found that diabetes and hypertension rates have grown dramatically in the past 15 years. In 1995, only four states had diabetes rates above 6%. Now, 32 states have rates above 8%. We release this report each year not only to examine the trends in obesity across the country, but also to track policy efforts aimed at reversing these trends. Obviously, over the past two decades, trends in eating and physical activity have changed in America. We're eating less nutritious foods and more of them, and we're not as active. As a result, obesity and overweight rates have climbed. If we're going to reverse the obesity trends, willpower alone won't do it. We're going to have to make healthier choices easier for Americans, giving all of us more opportunities and options. I'm now going to turn the call over to Jim Marks from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, who will talk about some trends we've seen in policy efforts and recommendations for addressing obesity in America. Jim?
Thank you, Jeff. This year's report should motivate us all, individuals and leaders alike, to redouble our efforts to reverse this debilitating and costly obesity epidemic. Jeff has done a nice job summarizing the big points. State by state, obesity rates are unacceptably high, and particularly high rates among racial and ethnic minorities and those with less education or who make less money continue to be striking and disturbing. Our nation is locked in a struggle to decide how to provide health care coverage for all of its citizens, like other developed countries do, and the biggest barrier is cost. Study after study tells us that the illnesses and disability associated with obesity are huge drivers of those costs and will become far worse in the future. Jeff has summarized the bad news in this year's report that points to a continued need for urgency in addressing our country's obesity epidemic. If there is a glimmer of hope, a new finding, it comes when we put this report in context with earlier editions. Back in 2006, we began looking at which states experienced statistically significant increases in adult obesity rates over the prior year. From 2006 through 2008, there were more than 30 states each year that saw increased rates from the prior one. Over the next 2 years, 2009 and 10, the number of states experiencing increases had dropped into the 20s. This year, for the first time since we started tracking year-to-year increases, that we've seen fewer than 20 states with increased adult obesity rates. So 16 states is the lowest number yet, and roughly half the number of states that experienced a statistically significant increase as reported in the earlier editions of F as in Fat. This provides an encouraging sign that the movement to reverse the obesity epidemic is gathering force, and that the policies at the state and local levels may be beginning to have an effect. But let me be clear, this is a small victory, and it does not mean that we can ease off the gas pedal. As Jeff said, no state has turned the corner. No state has had a significant decrease in its obesity rate, so we cannot yet predict a reversal of the epidemic. Also new in this year's report are many more examples and stories of federal, state, and local actions that are underway. Some states and communities around the country have been taking serious steps to address the obesity epidemic and are making important inroads. We have to assume that the glimmer of hope we can identify is due to these actions and many more that are beginning to get traction. But there is still plenty of opportunity for leaders from government, business, education, and other areas to come together and do more to make their communities healthier and to make healthy choices, easy choices, for families. Every year, the F as in Fat report tracks policy changes around the country. This year, we've seen more action at the federal level. For example, the Let's Move initiative has raised the issue's profile, and together with its partner organization, the Partnership for a Healthy America, they have brought together public officials, the food industry, advocacy groups, and others to address the epidemic. For the first time, federal efforts aimed at reforming our medical care system include a number of opportunities to strengthen our nation's commitment to prevention, and especially to obesity prevention. And probably the most exciting development at the federal level was the signing into law of the Healthy and Hunger-Free Kids Act in December. This marked a long-awaited victory, not just for the 31 million students who participate in federal school meal programs, but for all students. By giving USDA the authority to update standards for all foods and beverages in schools, this new law says that unhealthy foods have no place in our nation's schools. And schools finally will have more resources to serve nutritious and appealing meals. Kids consume more than half of their daily calories at school. We must take every opportunity afforded by this new law to lower the calories and to improve the quality of meals, snacks, and drinks available to students. Despite severe budget constraints, states are also undertaking a wide range of efforts to address the obesity epidemic, although at a slower pace than in prior years. We've seen policy action on competitive foods in schools, farm-to-school programs, and other approaches. For example, 35 states in Washington, D.C. have created nutrition standards for competitive foods, which include foods sold in vending machines and school stores and other locations outside of the school meals. 7 years ago, only 6 states had nutrition standards for competitive foods. And 26 states in D.C. have established farm-to-school programs. 5 years ago, only New York had a law that established a farm-to-school program. More than ever before, the 2011 report describes the types of local actions taking place in our cities and towns by police and firefighters, the military, mayors leading their communities, and individual school systems. The report describes action in large metropolitan areas like Baltimore and Salt Lake, in rural areas in Kentucky, and in the small town in Mississippi. I urge you to look at these examples of action. And finally, I commend to you the recommendations in the report. I've already touched on several of these, namely implementing the new Healthy and Hunger-Free Kids legislation, which could dramatically improve the nutritional quality of foods and beverages in schools, strengthen wellness policies, and encourage increased physical education and physical activity. Increasing our nation's emphasis on the prevention of obesity with programs like those embedded in the recent health reform legislation. And third, continuing to encourage and support actions at the local level by leaders in education, law enforcement, and the business community, in addition to the health sector. And last, getting the food and beverage industry to adopt strong standards for marketing to children based on principles proposed by an interagency working group earlier this year and by the Institute of Medicine back in 2005. I am an optimist. I believe we can build on the momentum that is happening in cities, towns, and states around the country, and that we can take hold of this defining moment to improve our children's health and that of their children. Reversing the epidemic will make our nation not only healthier, but also stronger as we ease the financial strain on our medical care system and improve the economic productivity of the next generation of American workers. With that, I'll turn the call back to Jeff.
Thank you, Jim. Anna, let's open up the call for questions now. And with a quick reminder that state-specific information is available for every state on our website. If you go to healthyamericans.org, you can see all the information as well around policies that have been adopted on a state-by-state basis and also rates for obesity, not just over the last several years, but the 20-year trends. Anna?
Thank you, sir. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touchtone telephone. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, that is star 1 if you would like to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment. Our first question comes from Drew Armstrong.
Hi, guys. It's Drew Armstrong over at Bloomberg News. You all mentioned a number of things that you could do about childhood obesity. What about adult obesity? What are some of the solutions there in terms of trying to turn those numbers around?
Well, I think we're seeing a lot of the programs being put in place now in communities across the country, in the communities putting work to work, the communities putting prevention to work program. That is supported by CDC, their efforts to address the obesity epidemic across the generations. So we're looking at things like making communities more walkable, making fresh fruits and vegetables more available at corner grocery stores, supporting the development of supermarkets. All of these affect both kids and adults. And I also think that, one of the things that we've also found is that one of the effective ways of reaching adults is through their kids and being concerned about what's happening with their kids. So in a sense, many of these efforts that are targeted at kids also have, in a sense, a dual use.
I think the other part of it is we know that increasingly, especially large industry, are taking this seriously. And so they are putting programs in place, whether it's discounts for health clubs or modifying the food available in their cafeterias, incentivizing their employees to get healthier by both being more active and watching what they eat. There are examples in there from the mayors of things that they're doing, whether it's pocket parks and making those more available, whether it's about sidewalks in the neighborhoods, and crosswalks. All of those things add up. And they add up in ways that you don't even think of. So there was a report from Charlotte where they had a light rail, and the people that started to use the rail, they added a light rail, the people that started to use it and walking to and from the train to and from their home and to work lost 6 to 7 pounds. A modest but a real decline. Each of these things helps.
And our next question comes from Mary Claire Jawanek.
Hey, I just wanted to ask you about BMI. I know you guys use BMI in calculating these numbers. Is there any concern that that's not always the most accurate way to find out if someone is obese in terms of not accounting for muscle mass and, other factors?
Well, I think we know that BMI on an individual basis needs to be assessed based on things. We all read stories about athletes who are, have very little body fat, and technically because they have so much muscle and therefore weigh a lot, may have a high BMI. to the general rule, and certainly on a population level, telling us what trends are happening within with BMI, I think are important. The caveat that I would put to that is less the question about are we counting some people as obese who aren't, is how we're going to ultimately measure success in our battle against obesity, because in fact we know that the major improvement in health outcomes comes from people losing 5 to 10% of their body weight. That's what the National Institutes of Health has concluded. And you can lose 10% of your body weight and still technically, in surveys like this, be classified as obese. And we're going to need to find more subtle ways of measuring the progress that is being made than some of these larger data sets are able to tell us.
So is that something you guys might be able to do in the future?
I think the main thing is that BMI is based on height and weight. Most people know pretty well their height and weight, and so it allows us to get this information from people. It allows it to be measured in schools and other settings easily. The better measures, and they are often complicated and perhaps expensive to do, certainly expensive to do for large numbers. So BMI serves its purpose well, as Jeff said. It really does allow us to track the trends overall in the population. The part that even people who lose a little to a moderate amount of weight, even if they're still obese, it still has improved their health. That's the part that I think is also part of the message for the American public. Starting somewhere, making some progress is good for your health, even if you don't get all the way as far as you'd like.
Okay. Can I have a quick follow-up?
Sure.
Just on a different subject, I guess just sort of in general, why do you think this is happening over the last couple of decades? Are people just eating more? Are kids eating more? Why is this such a dramatic jump? And I think that we know about the reasons why a lot of people are overweight, but why such a huge jump in the last 20 years?
Jim, do you want to start?
Sure. That is a question that, first of all, they are consuming more calories on average, and they are less active than they've been. But it is a lot of little changes in our society, in our communities, that have added up to that. So we know that portion sizes in restaurants are much larger than they've been, that the size of the soft drink containers that one can get at a convenience store are much larger than they've been. I'm of an age where soda came in an 8-ounce bottle, and now you can get a 44-ounce Big Thirst or whatever it is, that the equivalent of practically a six-pack when I was growing up. And people, when they have a larger size, will eat more. Snacking has gone up more and more, so that all of these things contribute. And now we've had the additional things recently. It's hard for people in many parts of the nation to even get healthy food, so that those that want to make changes for themselves or for their children are finding more and more barriers in front of them. Those barriers were happening at the school where they cut out PE, where the foods that are subsidized are those foods that are the least healthy for the children, and the barriers of just getting food that's healthy in supermarkets when there are all these food deserts.
Thanks.
And our next question comes from Marty Jameson.
Hi, this is Marnie with the Tribune. Couple questions. One is the idea, have you been able to track shifts between the classes of obesity? So there's class 1 at 30 to up to 35, and then 35, as you know, up to class 2, class 3. And are we, you know, it was encouraging to hear the bright spot that we're 16 instead of 20-something states getting fatter. But have we charted any progress in terms of more people going from 2 to 3 or from 2 to 1 or from 3 to 2, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and the short answer is we have not done that analysis.
Okay. Is that something that, as you mentioned, you know, even 10 pounds or 20 pounds, if somebody
decides
it's progress?
And what I said, so are people moving down the scale? And I, I honestly, my concern would be that the data set that we're using, which is a CDC data set, may not be large enough to get us statistically significant answers within the obesity class.
It's certainly state by state, I think Jeff's right, but they have done some analyses that show that it was that over the last couple of decades, don't know about the recent year or two, that it's actually the people that are at the highest rates, the highest class of obesity have gone up even faster than those at the lower classes.
Oh, okay. Wow. All right, and then a follow-up and somewhat unrelated. Could you be more specific about the quote, bright spot, which is so encouraging? Well, that was over the last 6 years that you had been tracking the trends between years, like 2006 to 2007, 7 to 8. You said more than 30 states were seeing
increase,
and then 2009 to 10, it was in the 20s. Can you be more specific?
Sure. In 2006, the first year that we made the comparison, it was 31 states. In 2007, it was 31 states. That's 2007 versus 2006. 31 states had a significant increase. 2008, it was 37 states. 2009, it dropped to 23. 2010, 28. And 2011, now, 16.
Okay, so that is a marked improvement there the last year.
But remember, no state has turned the corner.
No, I know. I'm not clapping yet, but
that's it. The sound of one hand clapping.
Right. Thank you.
And our next question comes from Hank Silverberg.
Yeah, I was just wondering. I may have missed this earlier. Specifically, what are some of the successful states doing that is lowering the obesity rate? Is it just coincidence? Is there legislation? For example, you mentioned the snack foods. Some states have regulated snack food in schools. Is that actually any evidence that any of this is working?
We need to repeat that no state has turned the corner in the sense of reducing obesity rates. But there is a constellation of programs in a number of jurisdictions, not just those that have seen something of a leveling off, that together will probably make a difference. And, you know, it sounds very simplistic, but it's about, you know, providing healthier food choices and providing more opportunities for physical activity. And that can be done through a variety of approaches. Some of the things around that Jim mentioned earlier, around school lunches, around, you know, making parks safer, around more sidewalks, what we talked about earlier about addressing the food desert problem, so fast food is not the only option in a neighborhood. Those are the kinds of things that together as a package will begin to make a difference.
I think the what we're seeing, though, is that while not everywhere, not as strong as we'd like, we are seeing some pockets of encouragement. Quite recently, Kearney, Nebraska reported that they've had a reduction in the obesity rate in their town. They were a community of modest-sized community that had four schools make enough changes in their policies in related to food and activity and even staff support that they got recognized by the Healthy Schools Program of the Alliance for a Healthier Generation. This year, 275 schools were recognized. This program's only been in existence about 4 or 5 years. So we're starting to see, then they have 12,000 schools enrolled that are all making changes. So it is, as Jeff's implied, and I think I've tried to, it is a lot of little actions that over time add up. And what we hope we're seeing with this decline in the number of states that are still increasing is that those actions are starting to slow the rate of increase of the epidemic, and we hope in the not-too-distant future we will start to see some states actually turn the corner.
And if I could just follow up, okay, as already mentioned BMI earlier, most doctors have thrown the body mass index out the window these days when they diagnose obesity. Could you define obesity for me in a simple term that people can understand?
First, I think you're wrong. I think most doctors still use height and weight as the way they determine whether a person is obese. I'm a pediatrician, and I know that that's what pediatricians are being urged to do. So the idea that how it's defined in depends on the age of the person. For children, it is over the 95th percentile that is considered obese. These were based on surveys taken in the 70s, where only 5% of children were over the 95th percentile, and now the numbers are in the 3 to 4 times that. For adults, based on BMI, it is a BMI of greater than 30, which is roughly 30 pounds overweight for a person who is about, for a woman who's 5'4".
So someone who is 30 pounds over the chart is considered obese. That's what you're saying.
That's correct. It depends on their height, though. It depends on their height, and so it may be more if you're much taller. But
there's a chart that bases it on. The reason I asked the question is, okay, is that most people probably would not consider themselves obese, but by that judgment, they are.
That's the first level of obesity. That's correct. And that reflects, again, what were the original rates back 30-ish years ago and where they start to see the health deterioration.
Just one follow-up question, if I can. I'm looking at your report. Is there a chart somewhere which lays out the states in order of ranking? Because I can't find it.
We have a chart with the top 10 and the bottom 10. So that's on page 14. But then we have an alphabetical listing on page 18.
Okay, thank you.
I should correct that. The alphabetical listing with the rankings is on page 12. Anna, I think we're ready for another question.
Yes, sir. Next question comes from Denise Mann.
Hi. I'm with WebMD. I actually missed the beginning of the conference. So my main question for you is, part of solutions, like you talked a lot about what can be done in the community and a local level in the home. What are some of the thoughts about some, like, the drug treatments and bariatric surgery? What role do you see that stuff having in terms of the obesity epidemic and curbing it?
Well, as with any major medical
and
or public health...
Who's speaking?
This is Jeff.
Okay,
Lindy.
Sorry.
As with any major public health problem or medical problem, you need to approach this with a range of interventions, everything from the kinds of community programs that we were talking about to medical interventions. You know, unfortunately, we have a limited array of medical interventions, but certainly in the context of treatment for severe obesity, there is a place for some of those medical interventions. But even those who, you know, embrace those medical interventions understand that the first step in this process is attempting some of these non-medical interventions, changing diet, increasing physical activity. And all of that requires a supportive environment for those who want to want to be making healthier choices.
I think the other part to it is that people who will start on the medications will have a lifelong need for those medications. We've talked about the cost of the diseases related to obesity. That will raise the costs even further. Bariatric and other surgeries like that are increasingly being used with people who have the illnesses related to obesity. They've already developed those, and so it is, in essence, a reparative. We think it's much more valuable for our nation as a whole to avoid having so many people in that situation, and the changes needed as a society are underway, we believe, or starting, and so we hope that can, as I said, take some of the pressure off the costs in our medical care system, where we're so much more costly than other countries.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from Katie Healy.
Hi, thank you guys for talking with us. I was wondering, you talked a lot about making healthy foods more available, but how can we make healthy foods and, you know, gym memberships and that type of thing more affordable? Because that's what holds a lot of people back.
And I think that's an important issue. Sort of on the physical activity side, you know, it doesn't require a gym membership to be physically active, but it does require a community where there are more opportunities to be physically active. That means having sidewalks, having safe sidewalks. It means making sure that parks and playgrounds are available and open for kids and adults and that they are safe. And it also can mean, you know, things like public swimming pools. Here in Washington, D.C., the city got a grant from a foundation, so swimming pools are free for all D.C. residents. So there are all sorts of creative things that you can do to make physical activity affordable. You know, on the food side, that continues to be a challenge, but there are innovative approaches being taken, for example, with the SNAP program or food stamp program, so that farmers markets can take the electronic sort of ATM-type cards and so that people have that opportunity, making food stamp dollars stretch farther if you are buying healthier food. So there are various ways that we can have policies that are supportive of and encourage people to make those healthier choices.
I think that one of the other things that we're starting to see is industry now seeing an opportunity and wanting to help if they can, are starting to make some changes, like Walmart with its announcements about they're going to be trying to remove calories. The healthy weight commitment companies that have said they're going to try to remove calories from their products. And the programs like in the food stamps, the SNAP program, where in some places they've shown that they've tried that people can get fresh fruit and vegetables get $2 for every $1 of food stamps that they'll spend, and they're finding people buying more fresh fruits and vegetables. So ways of affecting the price and availability are important for both activity and for food.
And if I could ask one more question, what rates would you guys prefer to see, obesity rates, that you think are actually achievable, whether that you think maybe next year, 5 years from now, 10 years from now?
We have to recognize that this is not a national diet that will be over in a couple of months, and I really appreciate your question. We want to see the epidemic stop, turn down, and then for us to continue to make the progress as a nation back towards where our heights and weights especially were back in the 70s when the first surveys were done. That's where the standards for children came about. And since then, the rate of obesity in children has continued to go up, so they now are 3 and 4 times, depending on the age, children are obese than were just 30 and 40 years ago. So I see no reason why we can't go to where we were.
Mm-hmm. And is there a time frame for when you think that's actually achievable? Like, that's obviously not going to happen, like you said, in a few months.
Yeah, I guess the part that I can't predict that. What we hope we're seeing is that it's starting to happen, but we haven't yet seen it happen in any state. So to predict when it would occur, I'd love to have it occur as fast as possible. I more want it to occur as surely as possible so that the changes made are enduring and become part of our culture, that what we eat should be healthy and good for us, and being active is fun and also good for our health, and we do it together.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from Misty Williams.
Hi there. I was just curious in terms of, you know, any of the data that you've collected, has it, you know, drawn any distinctions as to why there seems to be such a gap regionally, why we see so many, you know, states in the South seem to have seen their obesity rates grow more quickly than, say, the Northeast? Is there any, I guess, explanation that you guys have seen for that?
Well, there one particular factor that I think is important in looking at some of these regional variations is poverty. And if you may see in this, we also do an analysis in this report of how how income is associated with higher, lower income is associated with higher rates of obesity. And the southern states tend to have higher rates of poverty. And so that certainly could be one explanation. You know, and we all know that to make ends meet, people who have lower income tend to eat more calorie-dense food and tend to have less healthy diets.
I want to add to that, Jeff, with the poverty, what it is that we have subsidized certain foods like corn that become the source for high fructose corn syrup. And so the foods that have the high sugar associated with corn syrup are now the cheapest. So if you're on a limited budget, you will often go towards those foods that have a lot of sugar and fat, which are cheap and less healthy for you. So it is a problem in that what we've subsidized has tended to foster the kinds of food purchasing, especially for our lower income, that is most damaging to their health.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from Marty Jameson.
Hi, I have a question about the disparity that you've noted between, especially among the different racial groups. And I wondered, I know in Florida it's 38.8% for blacks and 28.7% for Latinos and 24.1% for whites. And my question is, if you adjusted that for income and education, does that start to even out, or is there something else more racially at play here?
We haven't been able to do that analysis with these data, and so it's not an unreasonable speculation, but it's not something that we can say with any, you know, with firm data behind it.
But in general, I would say that when you take poverty or education and adjust for it, you would see that the differences diminish. How much, as Jeff said, that analysis wasn't able to be done.
Is there any other factors besides race or besides poverty and education that may account for the disparities?
I think one of the ones is the cheaper foods are often the high calorie foods that are less healthy, and so we know that many of the minority populations and certainly those with less education often have lower income. And so have their purchasing habits affected. And then the other is that they're more likely to live in neighborhoods where fresh fruits and vegetables are not available. And even that the schools are poor in their resources and so less able to give their children healthy food and time for activity.
Okay, thank you.
And our next question comes from Deirdre Baker.
Hi. I'm wondering about the effects of the baby boomer population. I haven't heard anything about demographic effects, but you've got huge numbers of people ages, 46 to 66, something like that?
Well, you know, we do not, and again, in this report, we do not break things out by age, but we do know that the rising obesity rate is something that has significantly affected the boomer generation, and that is an important, you could almost say, time bomb that is going to affect our healthcare system, because as this population grows older, we're going to see higher rates of diabetes, higher rates of hypertension, higher rates of disabling conditions. So people who are overweight and have arthritis or tend to be more disabled than people who are of a normal weight. All of that's going to contribute to increased healthcare costs. And so one of the reasons why it is so important to be ramping up our prevention efforts today is, you know, as our political leadership is worrying about Medicare costs in the future, this is one perfect example of where if we don't do something to reverse the tide on obesity among adults, we're going to see much higher Medicare costs. These are chronic conditions that are manageable, do not necessarily shorten lives, but certainly increase healthcare costs and decrease quality of life. And so it's important to take the steps today that will reverse this tide, prevent the development of these serious chronic conditions, so that
as Jeff said in his earlier remarks, 17 states have had increases in adult obesity of over 90%. As you know, the baby boom generation, while it was not specific to that generation, they are sort of the largest bulge in the, and that pun was intended, in the demographic numbers for adults. I want to put that, though, that 90% or more increase since 1995 in perspective. The rate of increase in obesity in children is even higher, so that since the 1970s, it has tripled or quadrupled in children. So even as the baby boomers themselves are now of an age when they're starting to get the increases in diabetes and other diseases related to obesity, we've got an even larger wave coming in our children unless we can turn that around. So as serious as what we're paying now is what we see in the immediate future from the baby boomers, there is worse yet to come unless we can turn this around. That's why we think this is so important for our nation.
Thanks.
And our next question comes from Tom Kerwin.
Hi. By the way, Dr. Marks, it's Kearney, Nebraska. That's where my...
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
That's all right. No problem. We're in Georgia, but we are on the border with South Carolina, and those states are continuing to increase, but their ranking for South Carolina goes up. South Carolina actually has done a number of things to try and intervene, and yet, you know, a number of school policies and so forth, and yet, you know, the rates continue to go up for the adults. When you're looking at this as a, as somebody mentioned, as a regional problem, why is it that, you know, these things haven't helped, and why is there such a disparity between, you know, South Carolina and Georgia, between Georgia and Mississippi, between Georgia and Alabama?
I don't know that we know individual state versus individual state, and it probably is only at the regional level. I think what you're saying about South Carolina, and I presume there have been policy changes in the other states as well, is one of the reasons to do this report is not just to state what are the rates, but to say, are the changes that are occurring in the states enough to turn the epidemic? And are those that are looking early like they're turning the epidemic, are they doing more than the others? And so that's why we have the tables here. So what South Carolina has done are good steps, but right now they don't look to be enough to turn the epidemic. And then the reason for the Southeast as having the highest rates, while there's probably no specific reason, there will be cultural things as to what foods are preferred. There will be the issues of economics there as well. All of those things contribute.
If I could ask a real quick follow-up. How concerned are you, and I missed the beginning of the conference as well, but how concerned are you that as, you know, deals are being made in Washington, that some of these efforts are going to be defunded as, you know, basically a compromise to cut spending?
Well, I'm something of an optimist in this regard. There were lots of talk about a potential for cut in these kinds of prevention programs in the first round, and, you know, that did not happen. And I think it comes from a recognition that if we don't start addressing these issues up front, we're really going to, we'll never be able to bend that cost curve around healthcare costs, and it's healthcare costs that are really driving a lot of the deficit issues they're trying to resolve.
Thank you.
And we'll now move on to Beth Wishmeyer.
Hi, Beth Wishmeyer here in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I just wanted to maybe ask you a couple questions about, you know, maybe the obesity rate in relation to the amount of gastric band surgeries that are done. I don't know if you can speak to that, maybe what trends you're seeing, if there is an increase, if people are going to use that option as a way to lose weight.
We certainly have not looked at that in comparison to overall obesity trends, but we certainly do know that from other reports that by this kind of approach is being used increasingly, but we have, you know, certainly the study does not make an attempt to place that in any larger perspective.
Sure. Okay. Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Helen Watson. Ms. Watson, if you're on a speakerphone, please pick up your handset or depress your mute function. Your line is open.
Were you referring to me? It's actually Hannah Wolfson, sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
That's why I didn't respond. I'm in Alabama, and there are a lot of questions, obviously, but I'd like to ask you guys to talk about the diabetes issue a little bit. We're coming in first in that, and we've obviously seen that grow in parallel or in tandem with the obesity issue.
Right, and, you know, it is through diabetes that we see some of the most dramatic increases in negative health outcomes and in health care costs. And this is one of those, as day follows night, you see increases in obesity rates, you see increases in diabetes rates. And what is particularly tragic is we're seeing type 2 diabetes occurring in younger and younger adults and even kids. And so that means a much longer course of diabetes with far more difficulty in managing the diabetes and avoiding some of the very negative consequences.
Hannah, this is Jim Marks. I want to comment as well. Most people, when they think of diabetes, think of it as a disease that's taken care of in the medical care system, and it is. But even if through this or other health care reform, woman who has diabetes, say, and she's in her mid-50s, relatively poor income, will, under a good health insurance system, be able to get all her medications, be able to go to the doctor when she needs to, but she'll also be advised that she's going to need to increase her activity and to eat better and probably more fresh fruits and vegetables. If she goes back to a neighborhood where there are no supermarkets, and fresh fruits and vegetables aren't available, she won't make the changes in her diet, or she'll make less than she needs to. If her neighborhood is unsafe or unsavory, and her likely exercise would have been walking, she won't do that. In that situation, her diabetes will get out of control sooner than it would for another person. She'll need more medications, have hospitalizations, get her complications earlier. So even with a disease like diabetes that comes from obesity, the changes that we're urging that we have to make in our communities, in fact, they are important for prevention, but they're even important for managing the conditions we already have from obesity. So these have to go hand in hand, and I think that that's an important message to get out. This won't be solved by medical care alone, and it won't be solved by prevention and public health alone. Both have to be robust efforts.
How much of these efforts really require sort of a wholesale cultural change, and how is that a hurdle? How difficult is that to do?
Well, I hope it's not a wholesale cultural change. I don't think it is a wholesale cultural change to say that our schools should be healthy places for our children. If that's a wholesale cultural change, we're in deep trouble. I don't think it's a wholesale cultural change to say that our community should be healthy places to live, work, learn, and play. But what we are saying is that there have been, slowly over time, a series of changes that have made it less likely that children will get the kind of food and activity they need in school, and that it may, over time, make it less likely, or that now many millions of people live in neighborhoods where it's hard to make the healthy choices, even if their motivation is strong.
Thanks.
And once again, that is star one if you would like to ask a question. And we'll now move on to Lisa Bartlett.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
Hi, it's Lisa Bartline from Reuters. Some people have suggested to me that part of the reason why the growth in obesity rates is slowing is that because many of the people who are most at risk to become obese are already obese. And I'm wondering what you think about that, and if that may explain some of the slowing and the increases that you've seen.
I don't know that there's any evidence of that. That is, that that there are a large number of people that no matter how much we change things in the environment, so we give them more food and less activity, they won't become gain weight and become overweight. I think that in general we would say that that would happen to far and away the most people. Some are more sensitive than others. Some are in circumstances where their decisions are constrained more than others, so that they have less access to healthy food, less ability to be active. So I don't know that there's evidence to that. I think that it's a possible, but a highly unlikely explanation. And it won't, of course, explain why there are such large differences between states in other geographic areas, why there's such large differences between us and other countries now.
Right, unless one ascribed a biological benefit to geographic location, which I don't think anyone would do.
And we'll now move on to Laura Rosenthal.
Laura?
Hello?
Hello, yes.
Okay, so I'm noticing in the report a reference to the diabetes belt, which is kind of described as a parallel idea to the stroke belt. It says in the report that a lot of these counties are in mostly southern states, but then there are also outliers in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Virginia that are considered part of the diabetes belt. Pennsylvania in particular has made a lot of steps forward to establish farm-to-school programs, to add legislation that requires BMI screening. Why do you think it is that Pennsylvania is still part of the diabetes belt, even though it's making these steps forward?
I think that, first of all, the programs you mentioned are aimed largely at children,
mm-hmm.
and the obesity rates in children, and diabetes takes a number of years to develop, so that we'll see obesity rates change before we see diabetes rates change. They will come later, just as the increase has come later than the epidemic. So diabetes increases didn't show up in the first few years of the epidemic. It's only been more recently that we've seen those increases. So I think you can't expect it to happen right away. Here, and many states are making more of their policy changes oriented at children, as I said, because of the very high increase in obesity at that age group and the desire for prevention. And then finally, we know that it's a lot harder to lose weight than to not gain it, and so it will be a struggle. As it is for many, if not most, obese and overweight adults to lose weight.
Right. And one other possible explanation, for example, of the Pennsylvania anomaly, if you want to call it that, is that the population is, the average age there may be somewhat older, and so you're going to see higher rates of diabetes because the consequences of obesity tend to happen later.
Okay.
With no further questions at this time, I'd like to remind our audience that it's star one if you would like to ask a question. And we'll now move on to Kate Long.
Hi, this is Kate Long in West Virginia. Our public health officials say that they're looking at a 54% cut in federal public health funding in 2013 if the president's budget is followed. And, of course, Congress is talking about serious cuts in our Medicaid, which would make it very difficult for us to carry forward the health care reform law that would allow us to get a lot of people into medical homes and get them early screening that could perhaps prevent a lot of the obesity and diabetes that we see here. Why is this not a national priority? I mean, it doesn't appear to be.
I think it is a national priority, and while there have been some significant cuts in some aspects of public health funding, which are regrettable, and, you know, I think we would argue is the wrong policy move, the level of investment in programs for fighting that would fight, put in place the policies and programs that can fight obesity, certainly that investment is going up. The Centers for Disease Control just put out a funding opportunity announcement for the community transformation grants that are part of the Affordable Care Act. That's, you know, another $143 million that's going out in new money
Let me just finish. Okay.
And that's a commitment of $900 million over 5 years. So that certainly is an important piece of this. We don't know what the budget negotiations or the debt ceiling negotiations are going to mean in terms of Medicaid for current beneficiaries. But unless something is changed in the Affordable Care Act, the 100% federal commitment to the expansion of Medicaid is still on the table. And so in 2014, when there is supposed to be greater coverage for Medicaid in all of the states, that will be that expansion, the piece that is the expansion, will be covered in toto by the federal government, and what's happening with the state budget should not matter.
Well, it'll cover it for several years, and then after that, the states are going to have to pick it up. And
no, but to be clear, they will only have to pick up 10% of the cost, not the usual 50-50 split. So that's a very large subsidy from the federal government, and one hopes that, you know, by 2016, that the economy will have recovered and this will become a more affordable option for folks.
Kate,
I think the other point to be made is, though, that much of what's needed for prevention is not in Medicaid and but is in communities and schools. And that's very important for us, because if we don't as a nation enable our children to be healthy and productive as adults, they will not be able to get the kinds of jobs that they're going to need to take care of their families and to hold those jobs. And so we do have to take a long-term view on, as a nation, on a number of these issues. This is one where I think the prevention part is very much a long-term issue, starting now but continuing forward. And so I agree with your concerns that it's a problem. I think it has gotten more attention than it ever has before when you think of things like Let's Move and some of the programs that Jeff mentions. But all of these are fragile at risk in the future, especially if our economy does not recover.
That's the concern about Medicaid, and this may be a particular concern in West Virginia, because more than half of our children's health care is paid for, and their early screening and preventative measures is paid for by Medicaid.
Yep.
And I'll now move on to Katie Still.
This is Katie Steele from the Dayton Daily. You guys mentioned two of the main causes for the obesity epidemic are increased calorie intake and then less physical activity. Why do you think we're less active? What's happened to our society over the last 30 years or so that's made such a drastic change in people?
Well, we've sort of built inactivity into our lifestyles. We've built communities that are designed around cars rather than public transportation. We sometimes build communities, you know, suburban communities that are designed not to be walkable. And you combine that with increased screen time, whether it's watching television or sitting in front of computers. We've found all sorts of ways of entertaining ourselves away from the workplace that don't involve physical activity.
and we've taken PE out of the schools, even though that the all of the science that looks at it suggests that having that time available to children either improves their academic performance or certainly doesn't hinder it, and we know it's good for their health. We've done more for the athletes so that we have better teams, but we have taken activity as a fun way of playing out of the daily lives of our children and our families and substituted it for substituted screens for it.
Okay, thank you. And we will now take a follow-up from Katie Healy.
Hi, I was wondering, you guys have talked a lot about what the state and federal government has done to, or haven't done and now is starting to do again to fight this obesity epidemic. But what about, you know, private individuals, like families, parents, to what degree should they be held responsible for making sure they're healthy and their kids are healthy?
Oh, making this, you know, fighting this epidemic of obesity is a responsibility for all of us, and we should never, you know, ignore the personal choices and the personal responsibility we all have to make those healthier choices. The reason I think both Jim and I have talked so much about the policy environment and the physical environment in which people are operating is because we need to make those healthy choices accessible. You know, people can be as determined as they want to be more physically active, but if they live in a community where being physically active simply is there are many barriers to being physically active. If people want to have a healthier diet and there isn't a supermarket in their neighborhood, all of the willpower in the world isn't going to overcome that problem. And so that's why we talk about the need for government to help make the healthy choices, the easy choices. But that immediately is followed by, of course, the need for people to exercise personal responsibility, that we have to create the environment where it's possible for people to make those healthy choices.
I think Jeff's got it there. No government program is going to take the place of parents making the healthy choices for their children. But we've had policies over the last several decades that have made it harder for parents. So when we've taken PE out of the schools, that makes it harder for the children to be active. When we've subsidized the foods that are the less healthy for kids, that is a policy decision that has as its part of its consequence the consumption of high-calorie, low-nutrient-value foods, so that we see that there is a need to align the policies, which only government at state and local and federal level can do, to help parents make the choices that they know are valuable for their children and that they would like to make.
Mm-hmm. And if I could also ask, you talk about increased screen time as far as physical activity. Well, that implies to me that they can, you know, afford the internet and cable, and there is this talk about how we are living a fairly lavish lifestyle, obviously not when you're talking about people who are in poverty, but a good deal of Americans are spending money on going to movies and that sort of thing. So what about that, where they're choosing to spend their money maybe on that instead of the fresher foods?
Well, if they walk to the movie theater, that wouldn't be a bad thing.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, no one is saying stop watching movies. No one is saying, you know, don't use the computer. Perhaps use the computer more creatively and use that to, you know, be physically active. But we do know that alone, you know, that is a major, there's a major association between increased screen time and less physical activity and higher rates of obesity. And some of it is about not being physically active, and some of it is about what you're snacking on while you're at the screen.
I think that's an important point, that people do eat while they're doing the screen stuff. And the other is that for many individuals in poorer neighborhoods, they're worried about their safety of their children if they were to let them go out to play. And so giving them something to do inside is one of the things that they that is safer, is one of the things they do. That's why when we talk about parks, we also have to talk about them being safe, attractive places to play.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
And gentlemen, it appears there are no further questions. Speaker.
Good.
additional or closing remarks?
Nothing other than to thank Jim for joining me in this and to remind everyone that you can find all of the materials related to this report at our website, healthyamericans.org, and feel free to contact us if you have any additional questions.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank
you. And thank you for all the people who called in.
And that does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation.